Larry Kleinman, welcome again to KABU.
Great to be here with you, Bill.
Larry Kleinman co-founded with Cipriano Farrell and joined by Roman Ramirez to lead the organization Picun Pineros y Caminos. Do the proper Spanish, Larry.
It's Pineros y Campesinos Unidos del Noroeste, but commonly known as Picun because of by our initials.
And Pineros are tree planters. Yeah. Picun in its 45 years in Woodburn, Oregon, had many successes, became a formidable farm worker union, won several strikes for higher pay, safety measures, also sponsored for and fought for and won legislation regarding farm worker housing, work safety, pesticide control, won eligibility for driver's license for undocumented people, and made Oregon a sanctuary state, the first state in the nation to pass a statewide law stopping state and local police and government from helping federal authorities with immigration enforcement. In addition, Picun played an important role in winning the ballot initiative that increased Oregon's minimum wage, that importantly had a yearly cost of living adjustment. And as it grew, Picun added a radio station and built affordable housing for farm workers and the immigrant community. Through those years, Larry Kleinman was Secretary Treasurer of Picun, was also delegated to represent Picun in the Fair Immigration Reform Movement, known as FIRM, the National Lobby for Immigrant Rights. And in 2013, Larry stepped down from day-to-day responsibilities as Secretary Treasurer, that part of a successful transition to a new generation of Picun leadership, with whom he still closely consults. So, Larry, you've been organizing in Oregon for close to 50 years, and you've been deeply involved in the national level for 10, contributing to build a formidable political organization at the national level and developing national immigration policy for the immigration struggle. You've also, not least, watched and worked with people and families. Now, three generations of immigrants, many came here right from the fields with no formal education. You watch them become accomplished workers, political actors, and parents, bringing up a new generation of Latino activists. So, Larry, let's start with the basics, the numbers, who they are here and nationally, talk about why they came, compare them to their demonization in politics, why they risked a lot to come, and how they managed to stay and start new lives. So, Larry, give us the numbers and why they came and cartelization and who they are.
The first thing I'd like to start with, Bill, is that the patterns, broadly speaking, of immigration that we see today are, and I've seen throughout my adult life, strike me as fundamentally no different than the ones that were seen by in my parents' generation and my grandparents' generation. My mother's parents came here exactly 100 years ago from Ukraine at the close of wave of Eastern European immigration. They were workers. They spoke no English. They were from a persecuted ethnic group, in this case, Jews. And they repeated an experience that many before them have and many after them have, which is arriving here, getting themselves settled, getting involved in community organizations, in unions, bringing up family, who's the next generation, gaining greater education, generally upward mobility. And that's fundamentally the characteristics we've seen of the waves of immigration in my lifetime. The one big difference that I want to point out is that the immigrants that I've worked with my whole adult life have overwhelmingly been from Latin America. They are not considered not white in this country, regardless of the color of their skin, and faced intractable discrimination, many barriers visible and intangible, things that my grandparents didn't face, although they did face some religious persecution. But they were accepted as white people, and that there were many barriers that they did not face as a result. So that's a huge distinction, and I never want to lose sight of that. But I think we also sometimes think of today's immigration as being completely different somehow, and I just don't buy that idea. Similarly, the kinds of organizations we've sought to create in the Picun movement are very similar to the ones that were created in the 30s and in the 40s. My own grandparents were among the first residents of the first public housing in the city of Chicago and joined the Resident Association, were active in their community. That's exactly what Pekun has created with affordable housing through Farmworker Housing Development Corporation, one of our sister organizations. So many of the ideas of immigrant organizing and labor organizing are not new either, but they are in a new condition and in a new environment. A brief word about Woodburn and Oregon. When I got to Woodburn in 1978, there were 60,000 Latinos in the state. And today there are 600,000 Latinos. That's a tenfold increase at a time when the population of the state over those same 45 plus years was less than 100% increase. So there are now large Latino communities almost everywhere in this state, from small towns to big cities. Woodburn has always been sort of at the forefront, the vanguard demographically, in that it was one of the first cities of size, of any size, to have a Latino or Mexican majority. And that was officially in the year 2000, though it was probably earlier. The school district here is 80% Latino. So the critical mass is evident. And just as you said, I have known many families, known the first generation, the second generation, now the third. And you see those patterns again replicated of children having educational opportunities, going to college, getting into business or profession, or coming back to the community and leading, as is the case in Pekun. My successor was exactly one of those younger people. He's now 40, but he came to this country as a small kid and went to college. Adelmon Ramirez's successor, he was president with me as secretary treasurer for many years, was also grew up in Salem, a daughter of farm workers, went to college, is leading the movement now. So it's very gratifying to see that carried on with new ideas, new energy, new relevancy, but the same fundamental principles and mission. Lastly, let me just say, the situation that we deal with today that drives immigration is, I think, different than in other times, in that it includes a key element of the effects of climate change. And I don't think that was a big element driving immigration in other periods, but we continue to see immigration driven by violence. Today, a level of cartel-generated violence that's, I think, unprecedented, as opposed to civil war or government violence, which also continue in places. And crushing economics, the crushing economics of the working class in other countries, often tied back to U.S. foreign policy and economic policy. Those crushing economics are a driver of immigration. So again, those to me are the big factors. The one thing that I think is incredibly striking when we think about the immigration through the southern border in 2012, so 12 years ago, the composition of folks crossing the border was 75% Mexican. In 2022, it was 25% Mexican and a much larger flow at that. So it was probably around a little under 3 million and only 25% Mexican, meaning Central American, but also large numbers of Asian folks, Africans, Europeans included. So it's a very different mix of folks than we have seen in recent times. And about 6 million people have arrived in the last 3 years, many claiming asylum, fleeing climate change, cartel violence, and the crushing economics of their home countries.
Yeah, let's get to that 2 million people who are coming every year. It's in fact led to 1 million of them becoming able to enter the country, get jobs, even though they're undocumented, get jobs and start building communities. It seems to me right now also in-migration is getting greater. They're coming to a country where many of them have either people from their communities that they know, or in fact relatives and friends that have preceded them. And sometimes they come into this country expecting and anticipating getting a job working alongside of one of their friends or in the companies of previous immigrants. Is that accurate?
So I think that does describe many people, but there's also large numbers of folks who are arriving with no connections. This is particularly true in the Venezuelan community, I would say. 1 million Venezuelans have entered the United States in the last 3 years, and many of them did not come from Venezuela. They came from Colombia or Ecuador, where they had been attempting to make a life in exile and came to find that untenable. But what is the case, I think, maybe one way in which I think that pattern you describe is common, is that the wherewithal to make the trek north to get to the northern border of Mexico, southern border of the U.S., is almost completely controlled by cartels now. Human trafficking is a $10 billion industry, thoroughly controlled by them. It's very expensive and very dangerous. And the expense part of it means selling everything you have, if you have anything, or going into debt, which is very dangerous with a criminal organization, and or borrowing money from relatives or close friends that are in the U.S. that can send that. And that's how this whole economy is financed. We've seen, for example, 500,000 people transit through the Darien Gap, a dense jungle with no roads in northern Colombia and southern Panama in the last year, which is completely, it blows my mind to think that that's what the immigration flow consists of, or part of what it consists of. We've seen 7,500 immigrants from Mauritania in West Africa transiting up to the northern border of Mexico through Nicaragua, because Nicaragua has dropped all of its visa requirements for various countries and is actually charging fees for folks that transit through Nicaragua. That's how folks from other continents, as one of the routes, folks from Africa, from Asia, from other parts of Latin America, get that far north or across the ocean in order to then go over land. So this huge procession of folks, which is aided and abetted by the cartels, is driven by those three forces I mentioned, but also, as you correctly say, by the need for labor in this country. And I've read more than one analysis now that points out that had there not been the arrival of several million workers in the last 3 years, that this country would have gone into recession, and instead it has not. And economists are now largely crediting the arrival of immigrant workers. Not surprising to those of us that watch the demographics of this, because you're not building anything in this country. You're not taking care of people if you don't have workers. And the workers doing that work are immigrant workers.
This is happening. The 1 million people per year that the U.S. is absorbing, many of them children, of course, but it's all of the adults try to get jobs and do, in fact, perhaps leaving one woman to take care of the kids of many families. That's despite an effort to stop them. You know, we hear a lot about ICE in the Trump administration, in particular, efforts to round people up, deport them, an effort to force businesses to check the documentation, citizen documentation of all new workers, or perhaps old workers too. Why hasn't it worked, any of the efforts that are made, and Trump is sort of trying to, or at least demonizing the people? I don't think he's going to even try and round up people except as a maybe a symbolic measure to show that he's a tough guy and doesn't, you know, and is going to round up those immigrants. Tell us why. Why all that failed?
The Trump effect has been more impactful politically than logistically, as you correctly point out. As many an observer has said, show me a 50-foot wall and I'll show you a 52-foot ladder. and when you have a $10 billion industry dedicated to human trafficking with great capacities and ability to bribe local officials, and you have a 2,000-mile border with all kinds of terrain, including ports of entry that remain open for millions of crossings every year, commercial and human, you know, the idea that you're going to build a wall or any other one measure is going to stop that is just fanciful. And of course, it's largely for rhetorical demagoguery, not for practicality. There is, however, a really marked difference between how, even as feeble as the Trump administration's efforts were relative to Trump's rhetoric and the aspirations of the anti-immigrant team that he brought into the White House, led by Stephen Miller, even as impactful as that was, we've seen a marked change during the Biden administration. And let me just say that what gets a lot of attention, and you know, understandably so, in the immigration space is what's happening at the border. It is, and it deserves attention. There's a major movement of people the question of whether that's a movement of people that is beneficial or is harmful or maybe a combination is the debate. But let me just put it this way to you, Bill. Of all of the undocumented workers, undocumented immigrants, not just workers, all the undocumented immigrants who were in this country when Biden took office more than 3 years ago, 99% of them are still here, leaving aside, of course, those who died or those who left truly on their own. And there were obviously many thousands of those folks. So leaving them aside, who since 3 years ago have died or left on their own, 99% of the folks are still here because deportations from the interior of the country during the Biden administration have averaged 30,000 a year. That's 90,000 immigrants over 3 years as a proportion of 11 million undocumented folks. So that's less than 1%, right? During the Trump administration, it was 80,000 a year, so it was much higher. The Biden administration has all but curtailed workplace raids. And if you live in a blue state where most immigrants live, now Florida and Texas are an exception here, but if you live in a blue state or even in a blue city in a red state, but certainly in the blue states, you have access to a driver's license, and there is some form of disentanglement between local police and ICE. Either express in statute or in policy. In many of these states, it is in statute. And so there is the practical effect of what I call protection. And there are two things that are the deep aspirations of our movement, which is permanence and protection. Permanence is a matter we need Congress to act on. There's no way around that I know of, unless the Supreme Court wants to allow Texas to make its own immigration laws and then allowed California to do the same in the opposite direction. I have a feeling they're not going to do that, but that would be the only way in which what I'm saying wouldn't be the case. So we can only win permanence through Congress, full stop. There's just no other path, but we can win protection or de facto protection in a lot of ways. And I would argue to you, Bill, that today in the last 3 years under the Biden administration, we have had 99%+ protection of the undocumented population in this country.
Well, that's a plus mark for Biden. His support of Israel is an enormous minus.
Larry, thanks so much for talking to us today, and we'll talk to you soon about the whole set of interesting issues in the future of America and its immigrants. It seems to me a challenge for the left. And how do we deal with climate change? All those issues are open. Larry Kleinman has lots of experience in working on them. Thanks for talking to us today.
Appreciate the invitation, Bill. Always a pleasure to chat with you.
I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, take care, Bill.
You too.